There are moments in a century when it feels like you can see power shift. The month of January 2017 felt like one of those times. There was this.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Donald Trump's protectionist, nativist, dark, and ungracious speech at his inauguration.
Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs.
Contrast that with this the same week by Chinese President Xi Jinping at the World Economic Forum at Davos in Switzerland.
It is true that economic globalization has created new problems. But this is no justification to write off economic globalization altogether. Rather, we should adapt to and guide economic globalization, cushion its negative impact, and deliver its benefits to all countries and all nations.
Who would have thought just months ago that the leader of China would come off sounding more globally responsible and statesmanlike than the president of the United States? I'm not saying China's about to replace the United States as global leader, just that many of the people around the world who for decades accepted and even welcomed American leadership, imperfect though it sometimes was, are starting to have second thoughts. As the Indian actor Siddharth said to his 2.5 million Twitter followers after Trump was elected, "Hey America, you're fired." This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad. So look, I've been a direct beneficiary of the goodwill many people around the world have long felt toward America and Americans. I lived most of my adult life outside of my own country as a foreign correspondent, and I found most people, most of the time, to be pretty positive and open and friendly, especially when they heard that they were talking to an American. I mean, sure, I had my share of conversations with people who had a gripe or two, or more, about the way America was exercising its power in the world. I mean, in London, when I lived there in 1986, and U.S. planes left from British airbases to bomb Libya, I heard plenty. And then I lived in Southeast Asia and heard a lot about how, in Cambodia, U.S. bombing in the 1970s contributed to the rise of the Khmer Rouge and the subsequent deaths of almost 2 million people. And then in China, where I lived for 15 years, there were plenty of gripes. The U.S. was trying to contain and limit China's rise. There were big protests when NATO planes bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999. During George W. Bush's presidency, I had many a conversation with Chinese who said the U.S. military had no business being in Iraq, and I agreed with them. But over all those decades, these were conversations with people who accepted, even if they didn't always love, the role America was playing in the world. And many other people, sometimes the same people, loved some things about American leadership and culture, like the values of tolerance and openness and opportunity, and respect for basic freedoms like freedom of speech and assembly. And so, on the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, millions of people took to the streets throughout the United States, but also in 30 other countries. What you're hearing here was in Seoul, South Korea. Me? I was in Oakland, just across the bay from where I live in San Francisco. The crowd was huge and densely packed. For more than an hour, we were only able to shuffle forward a couple of inches at a time. There was lots of good humor, plenty of pink pussy hats, and memorable signs. Make America kind again. Make America think again. Make America vote again. One of the marchers was Fred Pingel, who works with Filipino Advocates for Justice in Oakland. He was born in the Philippines. His family came over when he was six, and he's now an American citizen.
We know who Donald Trump is, and the rhetoric that he's espousing, it's pretty much been the same since day one. He's just finding more and more room to be as radical and as hateful as possible. What really bothers me personally is how much support there is for that kind of rhetoric and how much support there is for the policies that rhetoric is going to create. Policies that affect my family directly and lots of people's families directly. You know, this is a country of immigrants, which is a cliche, but it's true. And we are working with and learning with and sharing our communities with a lot of people who are clapping for very hateful policies and very destructive policies for communities like ours.
How do you think this affects how America is seen in the world in general and in the Philippines in particular?
We're finding that the credibility of the United States is decreasing around the world, and that our position as a superpower is being undermined by the caricature that this presidency has become and how extreme it is and, you know, honestly, in lots of ways, how laughable it is. And we can definitely see that in, you know, how I've observed Filipinos commenting on Donald Trump. He's not seen presidentially. He's not seen as a statesman. You know, he's seen as a reality TV star. And now we are seen as a country that is led by a reality TV star.
The Philippines, of course, is a long-standing U.S. ally, a treaty ally, meaning we'll come to each other's defense if attacked. Indeed, the Philippines was once a U.S. territory. But its current president, Rodrigo Duterte, who's kind of a politically unconventional tough guy himself, has been cozying up to China of late and taking a what-have-you-done-for-me-lately approach to the United States. Japan is another treaty ally in Asia, and it's showing signs of anxiety, wondering what a Trump presidency is going to mean for stability in the Asia-Pacific region. Trump has casually and publicly mused about how maybe Japan should have nuclear weapons and should fend for itself, or at least pay more for U.S. protection. After the Oakland March, I went back across the bay to San Francisco, where I met a protester who wonders what Trump's ascent will mean for her and her country.
So you are carrying a sign that says, "Against Trump, where's my freedom? I am an immigrant."
Actually, I just moved to America like last month, and I am a new immigrant, and I'm very, very worried about my future in America. So that's why I decided to march.
Saiko Renard is Japanese. She just moved from Japan to San Francisco with her husband, Max Renard, a Caucasian American who spent 5 years living in Japan and who speaks the language. His protest sign and hers were both in English and in Japanese. And they both say it matters to them that America doesn't withdraw from its important place in the world.
I want America to think about more the other people, because America is a leader of the world, and so they have power to consider the others. And I believe America is very thoughtful and like kind country. Yeah.
For as far as the government, I think it could go both ways, because the current prime minister of Japan is also kind of right-wing, and so I think, and very nationalist, and he has a lot in common with Trump. But Trump has made a lot of, maybe this is not common knowledge, but actually a lot of things Trump has said have been very hostile to Japan, have been reported in the Japanese media. For example, when Obama had visited Hiroshima, Trump had made some very negative comments at that time, and Japanese people were really moved and excited when Obama had come to Hiroshima, and I think that did a lot to further the relationship, and making negative comments about that will really harm the relationship.
You can hear more about the symbolic importance of President Obama's visit last spring to Hiroshima in a podcast episode I did back then, which included a moving story from Hiroshima by my colleague at The World, Patrick Cox. That visit by President Obama was a great example of moral leadership. And Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe reciprocated a few months later with the first visit ever by a serving Japanese leader to Pearl Harbor. Showing respect for other people's pain and loss is not only a decent thing to do, it can create the kind of goodwill that can get other things done. President Trump, by contrast, spent his first days in office issuing an executive order to build a wall across the Mexican border. In response, Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, canceled his planned trip to Washington. Meanwhile, the doomsday clock, which is run by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, is now 30 seconds closer to midnight, thanks to President Trump's aggressive pronouncements on Muslims, Mexicans, and more, including climate change. So, on climate change. Sure, America was slow to lead by setting a good example. Americans use 20% of the world's resources for 5% of its population. Clearly, this is not sustainable. But at least the United States started moving in the right direction under President Obama. Trump, on the campaign trail, scoffed at these efforts.
Obama thinks the single biggest threat in the world today is global warming. Okay? Can you believe it?
At the time, a lot of Trump supporters said, "You liberals take him too literally, but not seriously. We take him seriously, but not literally." Well, in his first days in office, President Trump has shown himself to be serious and literal about rolling back efforts to halt climate change, including talking about pulling out of the Paris Agreement, taking action to allow a couple of oil pipelines to go ahead that President Obama had tried to stop, freezing the work of the Environmental Protection Agency, and effectively gagging that agency. Trump says he's pro-business, and businesses shouldn't have to deal with so many regulations. But representatives of 700 companies have signed a petition calling on President Trump to take climate change seriously. My colleague Jason Margolis at The World did a story on this just days after the inauguration. Here's an excerpt.
Here's a company everybody knows, Mars. They make candy like M&M's, Snickers, Twix, and Skittles. Here's something else they recently made, a plea to the new U.S. president. Barry Parkin, the company's chief sustainability officer, wants President Trump to know that they see climate change as a significant threat to humanity.
We therefore believe that we have a responsibility to do our part to mitigate that impending crisis. And the best way this can work is if everybody does their part. And that means all countries, all governments need to get moving.
Mars, a multinational based in McLean, Virginia, is one of more than 700 companies that signed a letter to President Trump and members of Congress, urging them to stick with international climate commitments and take action to cut the nation's greenhouse gas pollution. Mars and the other companies say they're already doing this on their own, as are other countries. Parkin says the U.S. needs to stay in line.
The thing the U.S. administration will need to think about is U.S. competitiveness and U.S. standing in the world. Global companies can choose where to invest, and they will invest where there is a supportive environment.
There it is again, U.S. competitiveness and U.S. standing in the world. So if President Trump's economic protectionism and U-turn on climate change drives companies away, and that, along with blocking refugees and Muslims and dissing allies and pulling out of trade agreements and security alliances and reducing our role at the United Nations, causes a loss of U.S. stature and respect in the world, how exactly is this making America great again? Our new leader has instead become the butt of jokes, including in places that have been pretty pro-American over time, like the Netherlands. The show Zondag met Lubach, Sunday with Lubach, put together a little video that's gone viral, introducing the Netherlands in what it says is language President Trump will understand.
This is a message from the government of the Netherlands.
Dear Mr. President, welcome to this introduction video about the Netherlands. It's going to be a great video. It's going to be absolutely fantastic. Our founding father was William of Orange, who fought against the Spanish. The Spanish, total scumbags. They fought against us for 80 years, but they couldn't beat us. Couldn't do it. Total losers. They're all dead now, by the way.
So this kind of silliness goes on for a bit, and then there's more of an edge.
People tell us, very important people, they tell us we've got the best tax evasion system God ever created. It's just unbelievable. You should tell your sons to put all your, their businesses here. You'll pay no taxes at all. Zero. It's ridiculous. And last but not least, we've got a great, great, great dependency on the United States. It's huge. If you screw NATO, you're going to make our problems great again. They're going to be huge. They're going to be enormous. It's true. Please don't.
For Europeans who survived World War II and have appreciated the 70 years of peace Europe has enjoyed since then, in part thanks to NATO and a stabilizing American influence in the world, these are anxiety-provoking times. It's not just Trump. It was Britain's Brexit vote, the rise of nationalist leaders in Hungary and Poland, and an increase in nationalist sentiment in France and even in Germany. And then, of course, there are the nationalist leaders who are already in place. Erdogan in Turkey, Netanyahu in Israel, Modi in India, Abe in Japan, Xi Jinping in China, Putin in Russia. It's been a while since there have been so many of a kind, of this kind, in positions of power, and it's a combustible mix. Putin in particular seems to be playing his hand well by using hacking, propaganda, and fake news to help influence the Brexit vote and the U.S. election. He's helped make central again a Russia that not long ago seemed to be a spent power.
Он ведь не был никаким политическим деятелем. Мы даже не знали о его политических амбициях.
Putin joked shortly after BuzzFeed published an unconfirmed dossier that suggested closer ties between Trump and the Russian government than should legally have existed, that while Russia has the best prostitutes in the world, he's sure Trump resisted them. And anyway, how would the Russian government know? It has better things to do than spy on every American billionaire who visits the country. Even if there's absolutely nothing to any of the allegations in the dossier, and U.S. intelligence agencies are taking them seriously enough to be investigating possible connections between Russia and Trump and those close to him, it's not exactly the kind of start that inspires global confidence in you as leader of the free world. Nor does the whole America First thing. That was tried once before, just before World War II, by a bunch of American nativists, racists, and anti-Semites, including Charles Lindbergh, who also expressed some admiration for Nazi Germany in the 1930s. Woody Guthrie wrote a song about it.
Hitler wrote to Lindy, said, "Do your very worst." Lindy started an outfit that he called America First in Washington.
After World War II, America reached out to the world and invested in a way that earned gratitude and a position of leadership for generations. It helped its old enemies, Germany and Japan, rebuild and become leading economies. It gave $13 billion of Marshall Plan aid to 18 European countries. America came off as generous, confident, connected to the world, an approach it seems that President Trump either doesn't understand or doesn't adequately value.
We will follow two simple rules: buy American and hire American. We will seek friendship and goodwill with the nations of the world, but we do so with the understanding that it is the right of all nations to put their own interests first. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine as an example. We will shine for everyone to follow.
But that's what America had been doing all along, imperfectly, but with impressive results over the past century. For much of it, in many people's minds, America was great, a power to be respected, a culture to be emulated. And to me, in the Women's March in Oakland, the day after President Trump made that speech, I felt America's greatness. A couple million people of all ages, of different genders, and many races were on the streets all over America, exercising their freedoms of speech and assembly without violence. This at a time when some Americans are insisting they have to carry their guns into church and into schools, just in case. In Oakland, more than 60,000 people turned out, and there were almost no police to be seen. One older African-American policewoman was leaning on a little white hatchback, blocking a road so protesters could go by, and smiling broadly. Strangers struck up conversations. One guy, who was impressed with the peaceful, purposeful, yet playful vibe of the march, said to me, "You women sure know how to bring it." Americans have long known how to bring it like that. The question is, what now, when our new president wants to march to a different beat? To close us out, here's a thought from Fred Pingel of Oakland's Filipino Advocates for Justice.
Trump said that he's going to make America great again. And I think that, you know, that has been interpreted and defined by his followers in a very particular way. But we're Americans too. So he's got to make it great for us as well. And if he doesn't, then we're going to be here every day, coming out onto the streets and meeting with politicians and really availing ourselves to every possible avenue so that we can make sure that he's making America great for everybody.
Rise up! Rise up!
That's it for this time. Comments, suggestions? Drop me a note at whocentury@gmail.com or on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Our webpage is pri.org/century, where you'll find photos, essays, and links to all of our episodes. This is episode 37, so there's a considerable archive to browse through. You might want to check out a couple of episodes from a year ago about whether authoritarian tendencies were catching on in the United States and around the world. All of our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe. I mentioned a couple of my colleagues at The World in this episode. You can hear Jason Margolis's stories on The World when it's broadcast or at PRI.org. Patrick Cox, who wrote the Hiroshima story, puts out his own podcast, The World in Words, with co-host Nina Porzucchi. It's all about language and turns of phrase, kind of like William Sapphire, with a lighter touch and a better sense of humor. And while you're checking out podcasts, let me also steer you to Otherhood with Rupa Shenoy. It celebrates America's diversity by focusing on the challenges and experiences of children of immigrants, or people who came to the United States as children. Her farewell podcast to the Obama White House was called Saying Goodbye to the Most Diverse White House Ever. Worth listening to, because while diversity in the White House isn't what it was, diversity in America still is. And that leaves me to tell you that Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Back soon with another episode. Join us.